Let me introduce myself because the due diligence. I am. I work here. I help people to get their dream jobs. So okay. that's the first thing that I was going to ask you something about. But I have a company with training, seminars, and coaching and stuff.
All right.
So
he's enough? A dream job guru.
Okay.
Yeah, that's I called myself that, and now people sometimes do that as well.
Yeah.
It actually worked.
Yeah. All right.
But that's also the first question I would like to ask you, because in your book, everything seems to be about minimizing work. You phrase it literally, I think. Okay, let's face it, the majority of the people is not going to be able to create his own dream job, so let's try to get rid of this thing called work and minimize it and make free time for other things. Mm-hmm. And then, as a dream job person, of course I don't agree, because I think that when you do the right job, the 4-hour work week is not the best thing, because maybe you want to work a lot more because you like you work so much.
Right.
How do you react on that?
The way I would react to it is, number one, agreeing with you that in some cases the dream job can be an option. I think for the vast majority of people who don't have instruction or guidance, it's very difficult to achieve that. And in that case, what I advocate is creating a source of income that requires and that's the coffee, the least amount of time necessary, so that they can then spend their time on what it is that they would want to spend their time on. So in principle, what I don't advocate fundamentally is less work, but actually more life, more of doing what it is that you would like to allocate your time to.
Yeah.
So what that means is that there are many cases of people who enjoy what they do, whether they're teachers or pastors or editors, for example, but there's a volume limit in many cases. So they may love it at even 80 or 100 hours a week for a very short period of time, let's just say as programmers who are trying to meet some type of milestone, but they do not want to sustain that and they don't enjoy sustaining that. But the concept of a dream job is an interesting one. I'd be very interested to hear your definition of it as well. One of the risks, I think, of pursuing a dream job, and there are ways around it, but in some cases, let's just take the example of someone who surfs on Saturdays to decompress from working from Monday to Friday. And that's a relaxing alternative that allows them to take their mind off of work. If they're usually surfing for 4 hours on Saturdays, but then they turn it into their job and they're waking up at 8 a.m. and giving lessons until 5 p.m., that passion then becomes, in many cases, what they label as work, and they associate a lot of negative connotations to that. I don't think that that's always the case, but I think that that's one inherent risk that people should at least be aware of, so that they approach it with that knowledge and hopefully can avoid it if they choose to go that route. But there are plenty of people who do love what they do. I do believe, however, that they tend to be in the minority if they don't manage volume and if they don't at least have some activity outside of that to decompress, just so that they can diversify their identity somewhat. But those are my general thoughts.
The definition of a dream job, in my opinion, is doing the work that you love. Mm-hmm. That's basically it. And I've written a couple of books myself, and one is called 365 Days of Holiday.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't mean that you go on holiday for all of the year, but that your holiday is something that can compete with your work and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
That you look forward to go back to your work while on vacation, and that you have an equal situation there. And I see a lot of people who have that situation when work and private time is mixed. There's no strict line between it.
Right.
I think that Boris is an example of that, and,
sure.
and his friends. Mm-hmm. So, do you know there's a manuscript on the internet? It's called the 0-Hour Work Week. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, I've seen it around. Yeah? I haven't read it, but I know that it's out there being promoted.
And it's actually about the same topic. And there was also a couple of months ago, there was someone here on Twitter who did a call for people who actually have your situation, like a 4-hour work week. And one person responded to that and said, well, I don't want to have a 4-hour work week like Tim Ferriss. I want to have a 100-hour work week like the way I do, because I like my job so much. Or maybe I should say a 0-hour work week because I like my job so much that it doesn't feel like work anymore.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And in fact, I mean, right in the book, I mean, when it was published 3 years ago, I make it really clear that if you already love what you're doing and the volume that you're doing it, why change something if it isn't broken? And I make that point very clear in the book. And I think that oftentimes there are people who want to promote A, B, and C who like to counter an argument that I don't make by misphrasing what I've written. But I make that very clear in the book, that there's nothing wrong with being active. In fact, I loathe idleness. I don't encourage anyone to be inactive. I encourage them to spend their time on what it is they want to spend their time on. And the practical...
Could that be work as well?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I feel that the purpose of many of the principles that I discuss, which I didn't invent, I mean, these are principles that have long existed, the 80-20 principle, Pareto's law, etc., that the objective is to maximize the time spent on things you want to spend your time on and to minimize the amount of time spent on work that is fundamentally financially driven.
Yeah.
And there are many ways to do that. There are many ways to skin that cat. And I've never claimed that my way is the only way, and I make that extremely clear in the book and on the blog. And I think you have to choose the combination of approaches that works best for you. And there's no situation between two people that is identical. And I think that's very important. But the idea that I somehow disagree with spending time on something you enjoy, if it happens to be what pays you, that's completely inaccurate. It's helpful to create controversy, but a lot of people promote arguments associating them with me that I don't make. I live in Silicon Valley. The whole point there is to, in many cases, create something that you want to spend all your time on.
Yeah.
And if you look at my schedule, if you look at what I spend time on, I'm very, very active. But very little of that is solely for the financial return.
Yeah.
And I think that's the distinguishing characteristic that is important to emphasize.
Yeah. So keep away from work for work's sake.
Exactly.
Yeah, and because you need the finances.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is the role of work, so to speak, in your life? What is because I think that back to the definition of a dream job, that work can be a very a big and inspiring part of your life if you do the right job, if you do the right work.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that? What's the role that work has in your life?
So work, it very much, and this is something that people criticize me for, but it very much depends on how we're defining work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's true. Because some people are like, oh, work, that's my job. I hate my job. I hate work. And then there are other people who say, well, I love my work. And those are two very different types of work. And I think the difference between those two people is that the people who enjoy their work are enjoying creating. They're either creating something or they're creating themselves. And I have no problem with hard work in that sense if it's applied to the right things.
Yeah.
I do have a problem with hard work, very valuable. There are a lot of smart people, a lot of capable people in the world, and it pains me to see how many of them, including myself long ago, who spend the vast majority of their time on things that they don't want to do or things that are not very important. So I have no problem with hard work as long as it's applied to the right things.
Yeah, okay. So can I ask you about how what your life looks like now? I mean, I like the concept of dreamlining a lot. I do it all the time, and a couple of days ago I looked to my dreamlining from a couple of months ago and I saw all kinds of things that I now have realized. So
congratulations.
It does work.
Yeah.
But how often do you do it? How often do you really sit down with a piece of paper or whatever method?
Every 2 months, 2 to 3 months.
Yeah.
Because it's exceptionally easy, and I'm not going to say it's bulletproof in my case. It's exceptionally easy to get distracted. The objective of most advertising and most promotion and most interaction is someone is selling you something, whether that's an idea, whether that's an activity, whether that's a dinner, whether that's a meeting, whether that's any number of things. And it is very difficult to maintain barriers while also maintaining good relationships. So for me, I revisit dreamlining, looking at the things I want to do primarily, on some level, the things I want to have, but much less so now. And I think it's important to revisit those quite constantly. I do that very frequently. I'd say every 2 to 3 months at a minimum. And I also, I mean, the general indicator for me of when I need to do that is looking at my emotional and psychological state when I wake up and when I go to bed. And if there is a sharp increase in any type of negative emotion, whether that's anxiety or regret or perhaps some type of anxiety that's associated with something that's going to happen or could happen, that is an indication for me that it's time to recalibrate and reset. Mm-hmm. And I do that very constantly. And for me, it's important to do that, to maintain course, so to speak.
And what kind of things are in your dreamlining chart now? What are the things like in a 3 to 6 month period?
Yeah, I mean,
achieve.
Well, 2 to 6 month period. So, I mean, there's a lot of, it's a combination, I think, of meaningful things and fun things. And I actually don't distinguish much between the two, in the sense that if you're not having fun, it's very difficult to do things that are meaningful.
Yeah.
To sustain the enthusiasm. So for me, I'll be going to Turkey in the next few months. I've wanted to go to Turkey for 15 years, so I'll be going there for a few weeks with a very good friend of mine, trying to learn some Turkish. I've also wanted to learn Turkish for a long time, so that goes hand in hand. The grammar is very similar to Japanese, amazingly, so hopefully that'll help. I am very focused on the new book. That's something I'm very passionate about, and it's really the book. It's on physical performance. It's really the book that I've wanted to write since even before the 4-hour work week.
Okay.
So the 4-hour work week bought me permission on some level to do this book.
Yeah.
And
what is it about exactly? Physical performance, but
right. So it's tentatively titled "Becoming Superhuman," and it's a hacker's guide to the human body. All that means is whether it's losing fat, gaining muscle, running faster, ultra marathons, jumping higher, better sleep, better sex, any of these things. Mm-hmm. About 20 to 40 chapters. All short, within which I've done experiments on myself and have other case studies, do experiments, mm-hmm. working with the top scientists and athletes in the world.
Oh, great.
And we look at the before and afters. And in some cases, the science doesn't match up with reality. And in other cases, you find some very interesting hacks and shortcuts. That's what the book is about. So it's intending to take a lot of the same shortest line from A to B that you see in the 4-hour work week and apply it to the human body.
So yeah.
I feel like a lot of people accept that they can't do ABC or look like ABC because of the genetics or whatever. And in most cases, it's just not true. So,
what is in most cases the key that people miss?
Having a very clear, measurable objective, mm-hmm. and testing all the basic assumptions.
Okay.
It's very similar to 4-hour work week in that respect, but of course the actual advice and the case studies. I mean, this is my first book I've done with photographs and diagrams.
Oh, really? Nice.
All of these types of things. So it's a very different book. It'll have a very different look and feel.
You had a very great video on swimming as well.
Oh yeah.
How to use your hand, and everybody's still using the hands in the same way. And
yeah.
There's a much more efficient way, but it still hasn't been discovered or even used.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So in many cases,
about that kind of thing.
Yeah, that type of thing. Yeah. I mean, it's really about the smallest changes that you can make for the biggest disproportionate result.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases, it's something very, very subtle. Like you mentioned in swimming, it's like changing the angle of your hand very slightly, and suddenly you're a swimmer and you couldn't swim before. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but it's true.
Yeah.
Very, very small changes. So that's a big element of my dream line right now, a primary element. Otherwise, a lot of it's
focused. When is it going to be published?
It's not entirely clear yet. Probably between September and December of this year. So it's actually in the book publishing world. That's very soon.
Yeah.
Otherwise, most of my dreamlining relates to spending more time with close friends and families, long dinners, things like that.
Yeah.
A lot of it's more on a personal, emotional level, because I feel like if you take care of that, everything else is just decoration and added bonus.
Yeah.
So that's where I am right now. Also, the startups, I mean, but I don't have any specific goals related to the startups that I work with, but that's something that I spend a fair amount of my time on. I'd say probably 25 or 30% of my time,
mm-hmm. okay.
working with startups.
So that would be 1 hour and a half.
Yeah. Right.
There must be an avalanche of people requesting things, blogging things. You know, you must have some kind of radical selection. You can't really...
Yeah, I mean, I've had to become much better at the things that I suggest in the book to deal with the after effects of the book,
which is
ironic and amusing on some level. I've had to really refine.
What kind of examples? Do you work with virtual assistants?
I do. I have my main virtual assistants in Canada off an island near Vancouver, and I've worked with her for about 3 years now.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things?
She handles almost all of my email.
Is that Amy?
That's Amy.
Okay.
Yeah, so she deals with 98% at least of my emails, all of my scheduling, almost all of my scheduling, just about everything. So she has a working document of processing rules for dealing with different types of inquiries and so forth. And I mean, the volume is amazing compared to where it was before the book. I thought I got a lot of email before the book, but I mean, I remember at the peak of the book's popularity. I mean, the book in some ways is becoming more popular with time, but when it was at its when it was number one on the New York Times, there was I remember a day or two where we were getting, you know, in some cases hundreds of email an hour. It was unbelievable, and you really have to have a more sophisticated set of rules to deal with that type of volume. And that's not the case anymore, thankfully. But I've had to become better at that. I've had to become, I think, philosophically more black and white about saying no categorically to certain types of things, just by necessity. That would include, of course, before the book, no one wanted me to put a blurb on the back of their book or anything like that. And it's like now I get anywhere from 15 to 20 books a week. And if I were to read half of them, I would spend all of my time every day, all my waking hours reading books. So it's
been, you don't want to just give away your quote because it's going to be, somehow the book may be rubbish, and then you're
right.
Your
name exactly. So you have to be very, very cautious about those things. In the beginning, I wasn't. I made mistakes and I learned. But it's been a great learning process. I mean, I'm more surprised than anybody else about how successful the book has been. I mean, it was not expected by anyone.
It's great. Yeah.
So,
is it a coincidence that she's in Canada and not in somewhere in the Far East? Because someone asked me to ask you, what do you think of the quality of the virtual assistants in companies like Brickwork or the other ones you name in your book?
Right.
Because she experienced a very low quality and saw a lot of critics online about it.
Yeah, so what happened, unfortunately, with the companies mentioned in the book is their quality was fantastic. Before they had 10 times as much volume, at least 100 times as much volume. I mean, Brickwork, I think, still can have high quality if you get the right person, but it's just like asking by analogy, you know, what do you think of employees in the U.S.? And it's like, well, it depends a lot on which employee you get. And that's true as well with virtual assistants. There's really no difference. There's a difference in the label, but the function is the same. They're doing work for you. And also has a lot to do with how well you manage. So I think a lot of the bad results that people
have, you say in the book as well, how strict the rules you are.
Exactly.
You explain.
So most people are not accustomed to managing. So of course they're going to be bad managers. I was a terrible manager when I started doing this, and I got terrible results as a result of that. And it took some reflection on how I was issuing the instructions before I realized, okay, that's very unclear. It's just bad management and bad instruction.
Input is output.
Exactly. So once I fixed that, then the output was much better. You know, garbage in, garbage out. Right? So I don't think necessarily that a given country is better than another country, although I do think that if you're dealing with something language sensitive, for example, in the case of English, that you may be better off experimenting with a country like the Philippines as opposed to India in some cases. But in the case of Amy, I ended up working with her because every time I had a very high quality exchange with someone else's executive assistant, I would email him or her and I would say, you know, I'm looking for your twin, somebody who does exactly what you do. Do you have any friends who are extremely good and are able to take on a client for an executive assistant? And Amy was one of them. She responded back and said, actually, I work for multiple people, so if you'd like to work with me, we could try to work something out. And that's how it happened.
So you still use the personal reference, because I went to Elance as well. We did a seminar called Turbo Management, which was actually, your book was one of the topics, but also many ways to make yourself extremely more productive. And we had a virtual assistant talking to us from the Philippines and was in the middle of the night over there. But I was trying to find one, and then you have this whole avalanche of people, and you think, how the hell am I going to select somebody who's good?
Right. So it's tough. It can be a difficult
personal
situation.
Personal reference would be one.
Would be one way. The other way, which I used to find very good people on Elance, was testing for reliability before skill set. So what I mean by that is, it doesn't matter how good someone is, and I've had this experience a lot also in the US, where you have a brilliant designer, a brilliant developer, but they're just not professional about deadlines. And that person, I would rather have someone who is good enough but always meets deadlines, and someone who is excellent but always misses deadlines. So I want to test for that ability first. And the way that you do that is, if you're able to create a short list of 5 to 10 people on Elance, let's just say, And then if it's a significant enough project, let's just say it's potentially a $500 project. Mm-hmm. Not only that, or even a $200 project, but you're looking for someone you can use repeatedly, then you would say, all right, I'm going to have the top 10 potentials. Let's just say that they have good reviews, but mm-hmm. who knows, that could be fake. So you have the top 10 people perform a task that costs $10 to $20 or mm-hmm. free, and you tell them there's a 24-hour turnaround or 48-hour turnaround. Mm-hmm. This is the deadline. This is exactly what I need.
Yeah.
And you throw something in there that's a bit of a curveball. So you might say, you know, I want you to call this number and leave your results on this number as opposed to sending an email.
Yeah.
And if they send an email, they're out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you see...
inexpensive test.
Right. So yeah. You have 10 people, and I'm going to guess here that 3 or 4 will provide good results following your rules and meeting the deadline. Mm-hmm. And then you select out
that's
of those
a
three.
Shift, yeah.
And that entire test costs you $100, but saves you infinitely greater headache.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's something I would suggest as well. And that's also very applicable to hiring people. I mean, use a probational period, or if you put it out on Craigslist, this is actually something that a friend of mine did, but you know, having that saying, don't reply to this via email, call and leave a voicemail message here.
Yeah.
And what you also get by doing that is you see how professionally they handle phone interaction and how precisely they leave an intelligent voicemail, which tells you a lot about someone. So I think that type of approach can be very widely applied.
Yeah. You also have this company who was actually looking for people to do telesales, and they decide not to meet those people because it might be a gorgeous woman, but she's not very good on the telephone, and then your opinion gets distracted.
Yeah.
And you also have this the company who has The Offer. It's a kind of an internet shoe company. You do a training the first 2 weeks, and after 2 weeks you get
Zappos.
You get an offer to leave the company, and you get $1,000.
Yeah.
If you decide to leave the company, and they say 10 to 20% of the people take $1,000 and go away, and they say we've made so much savings on hiring the wrong people and just getting rid of them after a month. I thought it was really brilliant.
Oh yeah, it's very smart.
Yeah.
Tony and Alfred. And
yeah.
The guys at Zappos are very, very smart about that.
Yeah.
In terms of building company culture, I think that they would be at the very top of my list for people who are interested in that type of thing.
Yeah.
As would be Chip Conley. So this is a side note, but Chip Conley, who wrote a book called Peak, but he's also the founder of a group of hotels called Joie de Vivre, based, I believe the headquarters in San Francisco, but he runs somewhere between 25 and 30 hotels, and also extremely good at creating a very, very high value, high productivity culture.
Yeah. The book Rework is also a big hit in that subject.
Smart guys. Good. Yeah, 37 singles.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about your communication diet, Timothy? You talk about it in your book, and I see you on Twitter, and I see you do quite a lot of things on Twitter.
Yep.
But how does your communication diet or your communication, I'm not sure what exact word you use for it in the book, but be very strict on your communication and on the communication you take in. How does Twitter fit into that?
So in strictest terms, what I talk about is an information diet and selective ignorance.
Information diet.
Right. But there's an important difference between the two, and that is that I'm minimizing my intake of information that is irrelevant or inactionable. So those are the specific criteria that I have for the information diet, meaning that if I'm reading a newspaper full of depressing announcements around the world, and if I ask myself, am I going to act on this data? Am I going to change something? And the answer is no, I don't see any value in consuming it unless it's enjoyable. Right?
Yeah.
So as far as Twitter goes, I was a huge skeptic of Twitter for a very, very long time. And you know, now I'm an investor. So the difference is, number one, I realized there are many different ways to use the same tool. Right. Secondly is Twitter is the fastest way for me to actually get very accurate, high value answers to questions that I'm unable to answer.
What kind of?
And it's the most effective way that I've found for me to share helpful tips or findings that aren't worthy of a blog post. And the in terms of questions, that could be anything related to polling my audience, polling my followers to get an idea of what people prefer versus A versus B. Mm-hmm. It could also be finding the best technological tool for a certain purpose. Mm-hmm. If you look at the revised resources and tools that are in the expanded 4-hour work week, we added about 120 pages.
Okay.
And not all resources, a lot of case studies as well, but it wasn't enough for me, I didn't feel, to look at tools, let's just say three tools for online backup, mm-hmm. and then decide based on 5 minutes of exposure which was the best.
Yeah.
So I would poll my followers, and if 80% of them responded back and said, we'd love Dropbox and Mosey, then those were the two that went in.
Yeah.
And I feel that increased the quality of those tools dramatically that were included in the book. And
I use Tungle a lot, and I think you tipped me on that one.
Yeah, so, I did, exactly. So Tungle was something I suggested to people through Twitter. And for me, Twitter is primarily for interacting and communicating with my followers, but learning from them. Learning from my followers and teaching my followers. And
Is it also something you use to be teached? To be inspired?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I would say I learn much more from my followers than I teach them.
Yeah.
Because I'm learning from 100,000 plus followers, and I'm learning from one person. I mean, they're learning from other people as well.
And do you follow a lot of people?
I follow about 150 people or so. But quite honestly, I follow my friends in real life. I mean, my closest friends I follow in real life. Because even if you follow 100 people, I mean, can you really keep track of that?
Yeah,
no, you can't. And I don't. I mean, it's extremely difficult, time-consuming. So, for the most part, I use Twitter for just-in-time information.
Mm-hmm.
So if I need something and I'd like input, or if I'm providing something that can be helpful to people immediately, I think, or a certain percentage of my followers.
It would be a good question that you normally ask to a waiter, what's happening in the world?
I can ask 100,000 people, right? So, instead of just in case information, I'm looking for just in time information.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's how I would use that. But I mean, I don't buy any newspapers. I read very few magazines. But there's no problem with, let's just say, I read quite a lot of fiction now.
Yeah.
And people might say, oh, well, what about the low information diet? Well, that's not intended to be actionable or relevant. It's fiction. It's intended to be enjoyed.
Relaxation.
If you're enjoying yourself, you're not wasting time. Doesn't mean you're being productive, though. So I think that's one of the biggest differences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, what about your new book? I know you've talked about it already, of course, but let me ask you a question on a more abstract level. What is it you think that you want to contribute in your work with your book or with your blog or with your activities? Can you
I think that if I can help in any small way, mm-hmm. to help people realize the highest potential that they have in any area, that's what I would like to try to contribute to. And I'm not saying that I will help them do it. Ultimately, everyone has to take these actions on their own.
No.
But if I can be very honest about my fears and my weaknesses and my problems and how I address them, and if that helps other people, and it's in some way instructive, I think that that's the best I can hope for.
Mm-hmm.
And the blog and the book and just about anything else that I do, whether that's television or otherwise, is intended to be a platform and a megaphone, you know, an Archimedes lever for doing that. Long ago, I thought and believed for a long time that I would be a teacher, whether in high school or at a university. And I don't think that desire has changed. I've just realized that I can actually have a broader impact by using these other tools.
Yeah.
So when people are like, well, what do you call yourself, an author, a blogger? I'm like, well, I think fundamentally all of the things, just about all the things I do relate to experimenting and then sharing the findings of those experiments.
Yeah.
So that's also true with the startups that I work with.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the things that made your book unique. You tested everything yourself.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people describing things you should do or shouldn't do.
Right.
You're the only one, I think, who actually tested everything himself and gave your personal views on it.
I appreciate that. And it's, I think, partially because I feel there are a lot of things that look good on paper. There are a lot of theories that make a lot of sense on paper. And when you try them in the real world, they don't work very well.
Yeah.
And
you have a lot of credibility when you've tested everything.
Right, so I feel an obligation to people to test. If I'm going to give advice, I feel obligated to test that advice first.
Yeah.
And that's also true with the new book. I think that's something that's going to make it very different from what most people have seen, is that I'm not just saying, okay, look at these studies, they suggest this, therefore you should do the following. I'm actually saying, all right, well, the suggestion is this, and I tried it, and in some cases it didn't work at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So spend your time on something else.
It's a shift from life hacking to body hacking, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I think they're both related. I think that if you optimize your body, you optimize your brain. I don't think that they're separate. Yeah. So, we'll see. It's a very, very different book. So, it could be a total flop. But I really did not want to rely on the same subject matter. I just felt that would be lazy.
Not
and
a
I felt
3-hour work week. Yeah, would be
no,
a good
no,
idea.
No. And I thought it would be regurgitating the same material. And there are too many people. And I'm not saying this is everybody. I mean, there are plenty of people who do a lot of very good original work. But I think particularly in the business book category, there are a lot of people who just rewrite the same book five or six times. And that's, I think, boring for the reader and boring for me, too. So I wanted to try something different.
Yeah. What if you would dreamline a little bit more, like in 2 years' time? Where would you like to be with your new book? What would have been how would it look in your ideal picture in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. If we're looking at 2 years as opposed to 2 to 6 months, which we talked about, I think that the goals would be related to. I think the book would have come and gone. I think in terms of my active involvement, I would like it to have a huge impact. That doesn't necessarily mean on a million people. I would like that to be the case, but if it changes the lives of 100 people or 10 people tremendously, then I'll consider it a success. I hope for much more, but I'm prepared to accept a lot less. And but broadly speaking, more of my objectives relate to improving education, both in the U.S., whether that's improving the public school system or replacing parts of the public school system with charter schools and so forth, and increasing specifically literacy in developing countries, primarily for women, because when you educate the women, you tend to educate an entire family. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always work that way with the guys, unfortunately. So most of my goals, I would say, in the next 2 years would relate to that. So I've had a lot of involvement with both already over the last several years, but I'd like to really dramatically increase that involvement. So we'll see.
And what kind of things are you thinking about? What kind of involvement? What kind of?
I'd like to. I'm not going to get too much into the details because it's going to be pretty. I think quite an interesting campaign. But I would like to. So I've built. Well, not I. Actually, I haven't at all. The organizations that I work with and my readers have built probably between 6 and 12 schools overseas and more libraries, and helped probably between 150,000 and 250,000 U.S. students, which is a pretty decent number.
Yeah.
I would like to get into the millions in the U.S. easily. Yeah. I mean, I would like to get far beyond that. I mean, 10 million plus in the next 12 months. And I would also like to build... I would like to try to build... 100 schools in the next 12 to 18 months, which is a lot.
In the U.S.?
No, overseas.
Overseas, okay.
Overseas.
Oh, yeah, for us, overseas is in the U.S. as well. So
right. Yeah, exactly. Sorry. So outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
But not in Amsterdam.
No.
In places like Sri Lanka, Cambodia.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah.
So like the new John Wood. Yeah.
Well, so all of the building of schools overseas that I'm doing is with Room to Read.
Oh, great.
All right.
So
I'm
quite close with John, very inspiring guy.
Yeah.
For those people who may be reading or listening this, I highly, highly, highly recommend reading Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, which is the book he wrote. Fantastic, fantastic book.
Mm-hmm.
If you're feeling like you're wasting your life contributing a few extra dollars to the bottom line of some large company, you should read this book.
Is it roomtoread.org, isn't it?
It's roomtoread.org. Fantastic organization. And the organization that I partner with to do all the work with the public school students and teachers in the U.S. is donorschoose.org, which is also an outstanding organization. Both of those nonprofits are run like for-profit startups.
Yeah. I mean,
they're very lean, very good management, which is, I think, the only way that nonprofits should be run.
So what you're doing, what is it you're doing in the U.S.? Because you're not founding your own school, but what do you want to contribute to the education system over there?
Well, in the U.S., there are a couple of different approaches. So there's the immediately effective stopgap type of approach, which means that we're providing funding to classrooms and teachers who don't have adequate funding for very basic tools. And that tool could be books, that tool could be field trip, that tool could be any number of things. And that's through Donors Choose, where individual citizen philanthropists, as they call them. Either of us could go to Donors Choose and put in a zip code, like an area code, or a zip code, which would of course, like a postal code to any location in the U.S. Battery's about to run.
Yeah, I know.
And you can donate money to specific projects and then receive photographs of the students using those things that you provide, as well as thank you letters. Yeah. It's very accountable. And then long-term, I would say it's fundamentally changing how the education system is run, whether that's improving metrics. To have the metrics, you have to have a common curriculum. And so the next, hopefully one of the blog posts that I'll be doing in the next week or two will be related to that common curriculum with some of the people who are trying to establish that in the U.S. So a lot of it comes down to politics and lawmaking, which gets very, very complicated very quickly. But
what,
that's something.
What kind of help do you need with that? What kind of people
The
do you
type
want to...
of, the type of help that I need is I need people who are involved in the process to educate me and to tell me how I can help them. Primarily. So I think the blog is a megaphone that I'll use for that. And certainly the blog is, I think, the most powerful megaphone that I have at the moment. So that'll be the next steps for me.
All right. Great. We'll keep track of that.
We'll
We'll be informed. Great. Well, one last question, because you say you live in Silicon Valley, and I will be heading there with my son, who actually was very impressed by the app trick you have on your website. Do you know which one?
Which trick? The eggs.
Yeah. The one you blow the egg out.
Right.
We do that all
the time.
My most
popular YouTube video.
Is it? Yeah.
About 3 to 4 million views.
Yeah,
pretty amusing, considering it's the one I spent the least time on.
But I was wondering if you have a good tip of a hotel, because we'll be staying 2 nights in San Francisco. I'll go there with him for 2 weeks.
Absolutely. You should check out Hotel Vitale, V-I-T-A-L-E. It's run by Chip Conley.
Okay, great.
Chip Conley's organization. So you can actually get to see the type of service they have, which is amazing.
Oh, great.
And it's right on the Embarcadero, so it's on the water.
Oh, nice.
And you can literally walk in 2 minutes to the ferry building, where they have the San Francisco Farmers Market twice a week.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful part of town. So
yeah,
I would suggest taking a look at that hotel.
Oh, great. That's a good tip. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay,
thanks for your time, Tim.
Yeah, thanks.
And thanks for your great... insights. I have it recorded. What do you want me to send it to you,
or
send a link where I'm going to post it?
If you could send a link to, just send it to Amy.
Yeah.
So Amy at 4-Hour Workweek, all spelled out.
Yeah, great.
You are, and just indicate that I was really looking forward to getting the link, and that I wanted you to pass it on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
do you mind me posting it before you've read it?
No, it's fine. Just go ahead.
Yeah,
no problem. Yeah, just, I mean, I think that my readers would also enjoy so you'd just be putting the audio up, or would you be doing the transcription, or how do you think you'd
No,
be
doing... I'll put the audio
up. Yeah, so yeah. I'll link over to it for people who want to hear about it.
Yeah, nice, great.
Yeah, okay. That'd be cool.
Thanks.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you very much.
Should you ever come back to Holland,
okay,
please let me know, because I'd really be interested. I do a seminar called MBA in a Day, which is next month.
Okay.
We're going to have 1,000 people, and they are middle managers working at the tax office or an accountancy firm, and they don't have the time to do their MBA, so they do the MBA in one day. We have Stephen Covey as a live speaker.